I see the topic for the second talk is up on the screen, so I can't deviate from the chosen subject, Islam and the End Times. I'm going to start with my own personal story on this particular subject, because about 10 years ago, the Lord spoke to me about speaking on Islam. I grew up in a Christian home, and I was very privileged in that sense. And my father was a good Bible teacher. And one of the things he used to speak on quite regularly was prophecy. And I remember going to one of his meetings when I was in my early teens, 13, 14, and being fascinated how he opened up the scriptures about the end times, the coming of the Lord, and various things about prophecy. I have to say, at that time, he was very much in the sort of dispensational mould and teaching from that point of view. Later on, he came to doubt that, and actually he stopped teaching prophecy for 10 years, but while he sorted it out and changed some of his views about the coming of the Lord. So I, from an early age, got interested in prophecy, and from an early age started reading the prophets and trying to understand what the Bible was saying about the second coming. And as I got older, I became, a Methodist lay preacher to start with, and started preaching. And all the time I kept saying to the Lord, I'd love to teach on prophecy. I think this is important. I want to teach on prophecy. And again and again, the Lord said to me, no, it's not time. So I didn't teach prophecy. And then there came a point in my life where I felt convicted that the Lord was saying, at a certain point in your time, which was some years ahead at that period, then you'll be able to start preaching and teaching about prophecy. So I waited, and that time came, and the Lord confirmed that it was right time. Several things happened in our lives, job, work situation changed, financial situation changed, and the opportunity to start speaking on prophecy came along. So that's fine, that's where I got to, but I felt very, very clear, this is 10 years ago now, that the Lord said to me, when I got to that point, now I'm going to give you the message. And I thought, hang on, Lord, I know the message. I know what I ought to, I think I know about prophecy. I ought to be teaching. But it was so clear for me, the Lord said, now I'm going to give you the message. And he just gave me one very clear word in my mind, Islam. And I had to teach on Islam. Well, I didn't know anything about Islam. So, Lord, how do I teach on Islam when I know nothing about Islam? And the Lord provided over a couple of years information on Islam. Initially it came through a colleague at work, a Muslim colleague, who had some books on Islamic views of the end times. Because there is a whole Islamic eschatology about the end times, and he gave me some books. I'm not in a work office situation now, but I love having a Muslim in the office. They're great. You see, with English people, speaking religion is a definite no-no. You don't speak about religion. That's one subject you don't touch. But Muslims, they love speaking about religion. And so you can have in the office an open conversation about your beliefs, hoping that other people are going to hear. I mean, you're not going to probably convert the Muslim. Some people say it takes about 7 years to win a Muslim, and that probably is about right. So you're not going to have an instant conversion with a Muslim. But you can make known your faith. So I always loved having a Muslim in the office. It was great. And, they will talk and they will say what they believe. And this Muslim who worked for me, actually, obviously thought I was right for conversion, so he had some books. And that opened up for me the whole aspect of Islam and its beliefs about the end times. And so that started giving me the information to start writing articles about Islam and how it fulfilled scriptural prophecy, because I could see the beliefs of Islam, if they came about, actually paralleled what the Bible said, but actually in reverse. So there Christ become, or Mardi, and they, well, I'll get into this in a moment, becomes our Antichrist. I spent about 2 years writing, and I then came concerned and thinking, Lord, I'm writing all this stuff about Islam. If it's true, you've given this message to other people. I can't possibly have it on my own. You know, there must be others. And so I started doing research. And one of the people I came across was Joel Richardson, who's an American. So you know him, do you? And I found on the internet this book, a study. It was a draft of a book he was about to publish on Islam and the end times. And so I got in touch with him and read his book, and 99% agree with what he said. I mean, because of all of us with prophecy, a little bits we don't agree with one another, but most of what he said I absolutely agreed with, and it absolutely matched up what the Lord had been showing me. But he also pointed me to quite a number of other people he knew who had all received from the Lord at the same time over that period of 12 months the same message. They were to go out and talk about Islam and how it fulfilled scriptural prophecy at the end times. Joel turned that study into a book, and I got in touch with him and came to an arrangement where he used to send me boxes of these books. I actually sold for a period of time hundreds of these books by recommending them to people and taking them to meetings and telling people, because it is the best study, I think, of Islam and the end times. It's out of print now. It was reprinted by WorldNet Daily as The Islamic Antichrist. I'm not sure if that one's still in print. I'm going to hang on to my copy because it's the last one I've got, but if anyone's interested, you can borrow the draft, which is similar. He made a few corrections and alterations. And that really confirmed what I had been learning about Islam and saying about Islam and how it fulfills so much scriptural prophecy. Now, there are some people who accuse us, when we start connecting Islam with the end times, of, you know, just reacting to Islamic terrorism and some of the horrific things which are going on in this world. Actually, identifying Islam as an antichrist religion is nothing new. John Calvin, writing in the 16th century, maintained that Muhammad was one of the two horns of antichrist. Luther wrote that two regimes, that of the Pope and that of the Turk, which represented Islam, are antichrist. And Luther observed from 1 John 2:22, who is the liar? It is the man who denies that Jesus is the Christ. Such a man is the antichrist. He denies the Father and the Son. And Luther observed, the Mohammedans deny both the fatherhood of God and the deity of Christ, hence they are liars. They testify against the truth of God's word. And the 1637 Dutch Dort Bible comments that the Muslim nations of the East would one day unite with one another in a pan-Islamic jihad against the West in fulfillment of Revelation 16:12. We can go and look that up later. So that's the Dutch Dort Bible. Jonathan Edwards, who was the great preacher of the American Awakening in the 18th century, also the first president of Princeton University, wrote in his A History of the Work of Redemption, the two great works of the devil which he wrought against the kingdom of Christ are his anti-Christian, brackets Romish or papal, and Mohammedan, Muslim or Islamic kingdoms, which have been and still are two kingdoms of great extent and strength, both together swallow up the ancient Roman Empire, the papal kingdom of Antichrist swallowing up the Western Empire, and Satan's Mohammedan kingdom of the Eastern Empire. So people from centuries ago were aware of the particular nature of Islam. Jim said we might get into Revelation. I'm just going to pick out one or two verses from Revelation to take us a little bit further. Revelation 13:1-4. We believe as Christians that at the end of this present age, A particular empire will gain ascendancy, and it's described in Revelation 13 as this. Then I stood on the sand of the sea and saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads the blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him power, his throne and great authority, and I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" The beast represents an empire. It also represents a man who heads that empire and personifies that empire. And at the end of the age, there will be this final empire which the whole world goes after and marvels, it says, marvels at him. It's such an incredible, miraculous thing. Revelation 19, verse 19. And I saw the beast, that's the same person being described, and here it's the person rather than the empire which is in focus. I saw the beast, the kings of the earth and their armies, gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army, that is, against Jesus Christ. In other words, this beast empire will lead the final rebellion, man's final, well, no, that's wrong, isn't it? Because there is another rebellion at the end of the millennial kingdom. But his final rebellion in this age, he will lead the final rebellion in this present age against Jesus Christ. When mankind get together and try and throw off and resist the reign of Christ. 2 Thessalonians 2, which I'm sure many of you will immediately know. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that's called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And we connect this beast, final ruler, with the man of sin described in Thessalonians because of his extreme blasphemy, claiming he's God, actually standing before this world saying that he is God. And God sends, it says in Thessalonians, a strong delusion on mankind, making them to believe what this man says. They will actually believe that he is God. Having rejected the true and living God, they will accept this imposter. That's what the Bible's saying will happen at the end. That's why we've got to watch and be on our guard, because we know this. And yet, so many in the churches don't. I was challenged, speaking 10 days ago, saying, you know, I was talking about deception and delusion, and someone after the end challenged me and said, well, look, you know, the Bible's so clear. Look at all the amazing things that are going to happen when Jesus Christ comes again, you know. And he quoted Zechariah, Jesus coming to the Mount of Olives is going to split apart and things like that. How can anyone be deceived? And I had to say, look, quote that to most people in the churches. And they say, oh, I never knew the Bible said that. Oh, no. Does it really? No, no. I'm sure you got that wrong. You've made that up. They won't even go and check it. And surely that's the ignorance of the church. They don't know about these things. Yes, you don't have to know very much Bible not to be deceived. Very little of the scriptures. Just a little bit and you'll be safeguarded. But I believe many, many people in the church don't even know that. The full extent of their knowledge is the creed recited Sunday by Sunday that he will come again to judge the quick and the dead, but they have no idea how he's going to come. And a man coming with all the deluded powers of Satan is going to deceive them. They'll see the signs and wonders. They'll see him coming down from heaven. Well, we better get on. I'm jumping ahead. Truth traditionally in this country, the Pope has been the Antichrist and the Roman Catholic Church the harlot. The Westminster Confession declared, nor can the Pope of Rome in any sense be head thereof, but is that Antichrist, that man of sin and son of perdition, that exalts himself in the church against Christ and all that is called God. In other words, at the time the Westminster Confession was written, the Puritan theologians who wrote it said, the Pope is the man of sin and the Roman Catholic Church is the harlot of Revelation 19. And if you disagree with that, you were probably written off as a heretic. You got it wrong. You couldn't disagree. And that existed for about 200, 250 years. An absolute belief that only the Pope could be the Antichrist. Now, I'm not a supporter of the Roman Catholic Church, but I think they got it wrong. More recently, in the 20th century, focus started going on to the revived Roman Empire, the European Union, fitting that very well, or a globalist conspiracy. And both are seen as backdrops for the emergence of this final man of sin who would rule the world. But I would suggest to you an alternative view is that this man, this Antichrist, this beast, this man of sin, is going to rise out of Islam. And that is the best placed belief system to fulfill prophecy. Just a few things Muslims believe. Now, I have to be very careful saying Muslims believe, because as you get to know Muslims, you realize that there are more views about what Islam teaches than there are Muslims. They seem to have two or three views each, and they're all different from one another. So to try and say Muslims believe this, well, it's worse than saying Christians believe this. And we know Christianity is in a mess, and you go and ask for someone who calls himself a Christian, and you may get some weird answers about what they believe. But Islam's even worse. But taking some of their books and assuming they're fairly authoritative and reliable, I will carry on and say what Muslims will believe. Muslims believe that Jesus of the Bible, was born supernaturally. But they also insist he was only a man. Muslims believe that Jesus was a great prophet. But they also say virtually none of his teachings in the Bible, because the early church corrupted the text and tampered with it. Muslims believe that Jesus was not crucified. They say that someone else was mistaken for him and crucified in his place. Muslims believe that at the end of his ministry, Jesus was taken up to heaven. And they believe that from heaven he is going to come back. But their beliefs about his return are very different from ours as Christians. So when Jesus comes back, he's going to descend from heaven. Now, to be blunt, I believe Islam is a satanic religion composed, created, and entirely by Satan. And therefore, if Satan wrote into the script that this man is going to be seen coming down from heaven, I believe we will see a man coming down from heaven, and that's going to wow the world and make many Christians think Jesus Christ has come back. Because he wrote it. And he's got Muslims believe it. And don't you think most people, when they see someone literally coming down from heaven, will be just wowed and think, that's something. That's one of his signs and wonders. All the signs, wonders, and lying powers of Satan, is what the Bible says, are going to happen when this man comes. Muslims disagree about where he's coming from. Some say he's coming to Mecca, some to Damascus, the Jesus minaret and great mosque in Damascus, if it's not been destroyed before that, but that's another issue, or Jerusalem. So they don't know, but they believe he's coming back and be physically seen to come back. And when he comes back, he's going to declare that he's a man, not God. And he's going to rally the forces of evil against all those who claim that Jesus Christ is divine. And he's going to try and eradicate them because they are the ultimate blasphemers. Did you know that in Islam, we are the ultimate blasphemers? We are the greatest sinners. We are the worst of the worst of the worst because we claim that Jesus Christ is divine. There is no greater sin and nothing more worthy of being punished with death than that claim. And that's what they believe. They also believe that when he comes, he will overthrow the Dajjal. The Dajjal is the Islamic Antichrist. So they've got an Islamic Christ coming back. They've also got an Islamic Mahdi. They've got an Islamic Antichrist. And I often used to puzzle me when I read Revelation, the verse we read in the Revelation 19:19, the beast is going to rally all the kings of the world, all the world leaders, up to Jerusalem to fight against Jesus Christ. And you think, hang on a minute, Jesus Christ coming back as described in Revelation, seated on the white horse, bearing the names King of Kings, Lord of Lords, all the armies of heaven coming with him. Surely the world would at that point recognize who he is and give up and accept him. But no, the Bible says they're going to war against him when he comes back. And this to me is the ultimate deceit of Islam. The true Christ is the Antichrist, and they've been promised victory over the Antichrist. So when the true Jesus Christ comes, all the nations of the world will come against him because they think they've been taught they're going to defeat him. What an ultimate lie of Satan to destroy mankind. I believe the Islamic Christ will come. He will support the Islamic Mahdi, which is the other leader who comes. But then in Revelation 13, I'm sorry, I haven't got time to go into this, but you know there are two leaders. There's the beast and the false prophet. And they believe there will be these two who will come. And I believe for a brief period, he and the Islamic Mahdi will be permitted dominion over the final Antichrist empire. Just give you some other reasons for identifying Islam with the beast of Revelation. First one is doctrine. 1 John 2:22, which we quoted, Martin Luther quoted, "This is the Antichrist, the one who denies the Father and the Son." This is the Antichrist, the one who denies the Father and the Son. The Quran, Surah 112, "Say, O Muhammad, he is Allah, the one and only, Allah to whom all creatures turn for their needs. He begets not, nor was he begotten. There is none like him. He begets not." A denial of the only begotten Son. For God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son. No, God does not beget. It's a denial. The oldest writings in Islam are to be found on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, a series of mosaics which go around both the inside and the outside. And they are almost all denials of the divinity of Christ and the sonship of Christ. One of them, I'll quote, "O people of the book," that's us, Christians, we're people of the book, "do not exaggerate in your religion, nor utter aught concerning God save the truth. The Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, was only a messenger of God, his word which he conveyed unto Mary, and a spirit from him. So believe in God and his messenger, and say not three. Cease, it's better for you. God is only one God. Far be it removed from his transcendent majesty that he should have a son." So that's from the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. The oldest writings, they predate the Quran by 100 years or more. From its inception, Islam has denied that God had a son. And there's no other movement, philosophy, religion, or anything in world history built on that denial. That is the heart of Islam, the denial of the Father and the Son. Many movements have denied the existence of God or tried to supplant him, or, you know, there's been much false teaching about God in the church and in the Roman Catholic Church, but only Islam has built its whole creed on the denial of the Father and Son. It's unique. As I've said, Islam believes in the return of Christ, but their Christ does not compare with the Christ we're looking forward to, his return. They believe that when he comes, he will deny his divinity, that he will deny he's the Son of God, and will persecute those who believe in a divine Jesus. There is a saying in the Hadith, attributed to Muhammad, that the Hadith are the collection of sayings purportedly by Muhammad. It creates for Muslims a huge problem because there are literally hundreds of thousands of these sayings, and they argue over which are real and which are true and which are valid and things like that. And so part of the reason why they fall out with each other is because they're looking at different sets of the Hadith, these sayings, and disagreeing with each other over what it really means. There's a saying in the Hadith attributed to Muhammad which describes him as follows. There is no prophet between me and him, that is Jesus, peace be upon him. He will descend to the earth. When you see him, recognize him, a man of medium height, reddish hair, wearing two light yellow garments, and looking as if drops were falling from his head, though it will not be wet. That's a far cry from our beliefs about Jesus Christ, who will ride in majesty into this world and shatter the powers of evil with all his followers with him. We'll be with him on that day. What a wonderful day. On that day, when the real Jesus comes, none will be any doubt as to be who comes. The next reason I believe Islam fulfills prophecy, and I'm a bit cautious, I think, to go into this one and take a bit of time, is in my book, Daniel Part 1, and that's the character of Islam. You know, in the book of Daniel, Chapter 2, and I'm sure most of you, again, are familiar with this, there's an interpretation of a dream that King Nebuchadnezzar has, and it's a dream of a statue, and Daniel is both given the dream and the interpretation. Many see that as a dream about four successive empires which will follow Babylon in control of the Holy Land and Jerusalem. That's how we identify which empires are in mind. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Four empires which successively control the Holy Land. I have to say, I believe, as I read it, there are five empires. The fifth is the feet of iron and clay. I believe that because when you go to the interpretation, more time is spent looking at these feet than all the rest of the interpretations. They're particularly important to understand them. And for me, the fifth empire, which succeeds Rome in controlling the Holy Land, is Islam. In fact, Islam controlled the Holy Land for longer than all the rest of the empires put together. Iron and clay is a perfect description of Islam, which is both very, very strong, and yet, as you see on your news every day, deeply divided. And look at Syria, how it's warring against each other, and we've seen it in Iraq, and we see it so many places. We see the hatred between Shiites and Sunni, so much conflict, and yet it's also very, very strong. Iron and clay is a perfect description of them. I've also noticed, actually, in Daniel 2, the word mixed is used. Iron mixed with clay. And, of course, this is one part of the Bible which is written not in Hebrew, but Chaldee. And the Chaldean word for mixed just happens to be Arab. How did the Arabs get their name? Well, they got it because they were mixed. That's how they get their name, because the children of Ishmael and the children of Esau went off and married. They didn't marry within the clans. All the other nations married within their nation, but they married Egyptians and Persians, and all different people, if you read the Bible. And they came out mixed, Arab. That's why they're called Arab. They're mixed. The timing of the Antichrist kingdom. Revelation 17, verse 12. Revelation 17, verse 12. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they received authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. 10 horns which receive authority. 10 kingdoms, horns represent kingdoms generally in prophecy. 10 kingdoms receiving power for 1 hour in order to give that power to the beast. Now, if you go back to sort of interpretations of prophecy dating from 17th century or so, you will find that nearly always they identify those 10 kings with Europe and the kingdoms of Europe, how it, after the Roman Empire, it split up into 10 kingdoms. That's generally how it's recognized. But I would actually say, well, that doesn't really fit, because the nations of Europe have had actually considerable power for a considerable period of time. But there are 10 kingdoms which have come into existence at the same time as Israel came back as a nation, which are growing in their power and will one day give that power to the beast. And I believe those 10 nations of the Middle East are actually what are going to fulfill that prophecy. They're all Muslim. All Muslim nations. And in my book on signs, I talk about the 10 nations which surround Israel as one of the signs. The ancient hatred of Israel by the surrounding peoples will be rekindled in the last days. And that's another sign for me that we're coming to the end of this present age. I'll just deal with two more reasons why I believe Islam fulfills prophecy. Revelation 17, going back a couple of verses, verse 10. 17, verse 10. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue for a short time. So this beast, which is described in Revelation, has seven heads and 10 horns. 10 kingdoms, 7 heads are usually seen as empires. 1 is, so at the time this revelation was given to John, the empire which ruled the Holy Land was Rome. 1 is going to follow them. Often overlooked in prophecy, but which empire followed Rome? Islam. Islam controlled Rome for the next 1300 years. So very often people see this interpretation of this prophecy, the seven empires, the seven heads, which have, in biblical history, the timescale of the Bible, they are Egypt, Syria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. That's the one is. And then the seventh is going to remain for a little while, a short time. I look at that in terms of the Bible, which says that Jesus Christ is coming soon. It's only one which is given a period of time to, so a little while. In other words, it's a sort of English sort of understatement. He's actually going to remain longer than the rest. And Islam did, in control of the Holy Land. If we go back to Revelation 13, verse 3, and I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So at the beginning of Revelation 13, we saw again that he had seven heads and 10 horns. Now, one of the heads has been fatally wounded. And to the amazement of the world, it recovers from that wound. Rome did not die of a fatal wound. And so often people can look at Rome. Rome petered out over 1,000 years. I mean, who knows the date when the Roman Empire finally came to an end? I wonder. Sorry? Yes, 1463. Right, well done. 1463, that's modern history. But that's when the final Roman Empire and Emperor fell. But for 1,000 years it had been going downhill. Gradually the Muslims had taken more and more of the Eastern Empire. Yes, the Western Empire fell much earlier. It wasn't a fatal wound. I'm going to suggest to you the empire which received a fatal wound was Islam. A quote from an Islamic organization which is seeking to restore the caliph and bring it back, one of many Islamic organizations. I think if we go on in the autumn, I'm going to suggest to you, we haven't prayed about which subject we're going to tackle, but one of these subjects I'd like to tackle, because I've done this before, is the Muslim Brotherhood, and explain to you the history and beliefs and ambitions and aims of the Muslim Brotherhood, because they're coming more and more prominent in the Middle East. They exist to restore the caliph. That's their prime purpose. But another organization which exists to restore the caliph. The caliph is the ruler of Islam. He is both pope and president. He combines both roles, religious and political, and he unites the whole Islamic world. So this is from this organization. The 3rd of March 1924, the world was plunged into darkness. The Khalifa, his light spread from east and west for over 1,000 years, was brought to an end. The consequences were unimaginable. Death, destruction, chaos, exploitation. After 80 years of the absence of the Khalifa, the Muslim world has awakened from its slumber, and the Ummah, that's the community of the world's Muslims, is ready to resume its political destiny. From a darkness will emerge new light. In other words, Islam received a fatal wound. Britain forced Turkey to remove the caliph and kick him out. He wasn't worried, actually. The last caliph, his main interest was collecting butterflies and pictures, and he retired very happily to Paris and lived out his life. But the rest of the Muslim world was bothered by his departure. And if we did do the Muslim Brotherhood, I can explain a lot more about its origins and how it grew out of this real upset. Islam was crushed because its head was cut off, fatally wounded, and destroyed. That far better fits the picture in Revelation of a fatal wound from which it's recovering. And today it is recovering and coming back as a major force. And we haven't yet seen what is really going to come about. I perhaps didn't say, but when I was told by the Lord to write these articles on Islam, one of the themes I had to tackle was that Britain would come under Islamic domination. And we've got to face that. That's part of it. And God is punishing us already, that our final judgment will be Islam. And that's what the Lord's bringing. So for decades, Islam has been seen as a moribund religion, but it is coming back to life. And I believe as it's energized, when finally it's Mahdi, it's Jesus Christ, come back, then we will see a power like we've not seen. At the moment, Islam is divided, it's crushed, it's fighting in amongst itself. But when it has a head again to unify it, it will come a power like the world has never seen before and rise to domination. So Islam is growing in influence day by day. One final thing, the completeness of Scripture. Galatians 4:22 and then 28 and 29. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and the other by the free woman. Now you brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. At that time the son born in the ordinary way persecuted the son born in the power of the Spirit. It is the same now. Abraham had two sons, Ishmael born through natural means, Isaac born as a result of Abraham's faith in God's promise. So Christians by faith are descendants of Abraham. That's our position in Christ. Islam looks to Abraham as well. But as you know, if you talk to Muslims, they claim their descent through Ishmael. The final conflict is going to be between the children of faith, Isaac, and the children of works, Ishmael. And at the very end of this age, it's going to be exactly as it all started 4,000 years before. I was in a meeting, as I said, 10 days ago. A Jewess was sitting there, and she, because this had come up, and she commented, that's exactly what we believe as Jews. The final conflict is between faith and works, between Ishmael and Isaac. That's where it ends. So I believe Islam will arise and gain more power. I believe the West is in a critical terminal state now. It's not long before we will go under. And Islam will prove the stronger. And that's the final, it is a sign that we are approaching the end of this age. There is much more actually to be said about how Islam's beliefs parallel and yet are the opposite to the Christian beliefs about the end of the age. But it is so remarkable that so much of what they believe is the reverse of what we believe. So their Christ is the Antichrist, our Antichrist, and vice versa. And there's so much. Joel Richardson did an excellent job in putting it together in his book. I'm sorry, it may be difficult to get hold of now, but you can look on the internet and maybe you'll find it either under this title, Antichrist, Islam's Awaited Messiah, or The Islamic Antichrist. Very good read. So I leave that with you. Perhaps we'll look at this again another time in more depth, but that's an introduction to my beliefs that Islam is going to prove to be the final empire of the beast.